Welcome to the No Direction Podcast, PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage. Remember, we con when you can't.
Okay, good morning, everyone. So,
good morning.
I know on the program it says Amber's gotten Robert Brooks, and then last date in the bar, Robert was like, hey, so my plane leaves at like 5 in the morning tomorrow. sorry about that. So I'd hoped you would be here to talk about like some of the development that went into Athera and like how they, you know, got inspiration for detailing some of the races and stuff, but you'll just have to deal with me. Thank you so much for coming to Monday morning seminar. This weekend has been just incredible. I hope you all had a wonderful time because I sure did at PaizoCon. And PaizoCon. My voice, as you can tell, is starting to go. I've run a bunch of games this weekend and been on a bunch of panels and so forth, but I think I got 1 hour left in me, so that's good. I hope you don't mind if I just stand and talk. These tables are kind of awkwardly positioned, and I don't really want to move them around, so I actually usually stand when I GM. I somehow just got into the habit, I think, because it's easy to like reach and move minis around, and also I can like stride and gesture and things like that, so it feels kind of natural. So this seminar is called The Bones of Fluff, and it's all about how there's, in game writing slang, you probably know, fluff is the sort of setting material, characters, backstory, all the things that aren't rules-based. Rules-based stuff is called crunch, so a new feat would be crunch, but a two-page description of a city would be fluff. And I happen to really, really love writing fluff. I do some crunch as well, but I find that setting material is where I have the most enjoyment writing. And so over the years, I've developed a number of tricks and kind of shortcuts that I use that I thought would be helpful for GMs as they're creating their own work, for writers as they're doing projects, and also for players as you're, you know, trying to build the story of your particular character going through the world. So I'd like to start just by giving you a couple of the tips and tricks that I use, and then we will kind of chat more generally, and if you have questions, you can just throw them out. The project that I worked on that sort of inspired this particular panel was Iron Fang Invasion. So this is the new adventure path that's, I think, currently running. And the first adventure, the one that I wrote, was called Trail of the Hunted. And in it, no spoilers, but in it, there's an attack on a town, a small town, and the players wind up helping the survivors of the attack survive in the Fangwood in Nermathus. And there's still these attackers kind of wandering around in packs, so there's some secrecy. They've got to protect the people. And also, they had to flee kind of in the middle of the night, so they didn't bring a lot of supplies with them, and there's a lot of scavenging and trying to find shelter and food for these survivors, and also keep their spirits up. So a lot of the setting of that first adventure is the Fangwood. And my first step was to decide on a real world analogy for Nermathus. This is often what I do when I know I'm going to be writing a lot of wilderness material, because it makes it a lot easier to be more specific about what exactly the players could potentially find or interact with during the course of the adventure. I decided on actually the Pacific Northwest and Western Canada kind of area. It's a temperate, it's got a lot of old growth forests. You've got, like, I think the only rainforest in North America is here in Washington State. And it seemed like the right sort of climate to represent Nermathus. And so one of the things that happens in the adventure is if the survivors are feeling good about their lives, like they think the players are doing a great job, they're sure that they're gonna go back home one day, and they just generally have a high morale, they decide to name themselves and make like a banner to kind of rally around. And I was gonna originally call it like the Green Banner or something, and I was like, that's not very specific. So I had a bunch of pages open to like flora and fauna of British Columbia and Washington State. And when I needed something like a tree bough that they would use, I would actually go and look at what sort of trees are common in, you know, Western BC and Washington State. And I finally wound up deciding on hemlock, which is a common sort of tree that grows in this area, but also has a cool fantasy name to it. And there's always that feeling you get where you're like, yeah, that's the thing. And usually it makes it through development, and that's always a good feeling. So those sort of small touches are something that I felt really helped bring this adventure to life, really helped immerse the players in the world. I did the same for the kind of fruit they would find. They run into apple trees. Apple trees are very common in Western BC and in Washington State. They ran into some grapevines, or they encountered grapevines. CR2 grapevines. Very dangerous monster.
I mean, there are vine monsters in the BC area that entry, so.
There are. I think I made that vine monster.
No one eats the grapes. It's dangerous.
And that would attract predators who eat, you know, fallen fruit and things like that. So that led me to researching birds and the kind of animals they find. And of course, the adventure was also supposed to represent a classic fantasy, you know, inspired by the original sort of Dungeons and Dragons type adventure. And so I had to go with wolves, but I had an actual den of wolves, and I went online and I was like, what do wolf dens look like? And wound up having this cool like burrow under a tree where these wolf pups are sort of sleeping, and then there's a wolf mother guarding them and so forth. And I really enjoy making little details like that kind of shine in my work, because it takes a relatively small amount of time. You know, researching wolf dens, that maybe took me like 15 minutes. And sometimes you find really interesting things that lead you to like, oh, I should do this in my adventure. That would be really cool. There's also an underground burrow later in that adventure where some creatures are living underground and the players have to go down and do their adventuring thing. And I, again, just a quick web search, what kind of natural stone exists in the ground in this sort of area. And I found that amethyst was actually really common as a byproduct of mining in the Pacific Northwest. And so I made amethyst like kind of a running theme, like there were amethyst streaks in the walls as you went down, and the group leader had like some kind of like an amethyst crown or something, I think. And I could have pulled amethyst just out of a hat, but for people who are from the area, it's an interesting little detail, and it is just inspirational to me personally. It gave me the idea to use a chrismal as one of the monsters in the underground lair that's made of these natural sort of crystals that occur. And it can just add to a sense of continuity with the players when they feel like this whole world is part of a whole. I'll switch to a more modern example now. I recently worked on a game called Weave, which is a computer game done by a company called Monocle Society. And I was writing a modern set game. It was set in 2017 in Southern California. And it dealt with high school students and the people in their lives. School officials, parents, you know, part-time job employers, that sort of thing. And I wound up doing a lot of the same sort of research I did for Iron Fang, where I looked at the flora and fauna of Southern California. And so in the fake city I made up, the central park area is called Joshua Park, because the Joshua tree is really common in sort of the desert areas there. And it also makes it just sound like a real place. Like, I'm sure there really are Joshua Parks somewhere in California. I don't know them specifically, but it sounds like the kind of place that really would exist. And so that can add like a little bit of verisimilitude to the game. But one of the other things I did to really bring the game into focus was use popular baby name lists from different years. So the students who are in high school, I would search baby names 2000 and get names from the year 2000. So their names were Hannah and Kaylee and Olivia and things like that. And for their teachers, I would search baby names 1980, and they would be named Stephanie and Jessica and Jennifer and things like that. And it's a small detail again, but I read a lot of short fiction on Reddit that I really enjoy. there's a forum called Super Short Scary Stories where people write like 500 word horror stories, and I really enjoy it. And I noticed time and time again that authors are setting pieces in, you know, the modern day and calling their characters like Susie and you know, Bobby. And I'm like, I know those names exist, but they're really not common for modern children. You don't go to a lot of schools today and find, like, you know, 10-year-olds named Susie anymore.
It's a 1950s thing.
Yeah. That's my mom's name. I mean, it's a beautiful name. I love it. But it always kind of just took me a little bit out. Like, it was like the author was just using the first name that came into mind. And so, like I said, small touches like that can really enliven a piece of writing. On the fantasy side, I'd like to use a variety of structures of names in a piece. It's, if you're using names just off the top of your head, you can run the risk of having all your characters sound kind of the same. You know, you get Kaylin and Kayleth and Cardamom and so forth, and then the players are getting confused, like, why does everyone have two syllables names that start with consonants? You're like, I don't know. So if you're extraordinarily organized, like maybe me, if I'm writing a really, really big piece where there's going to be like 20 or so character names, I'll actually just keep a little tally of what first initials I'm using, just like on a bit of paper next to me. So I just make sure I don't have four characters all starting with M, because in an adventure that can be confusing to the players, even if they're significantly different. And so a variety of first initials kind of helps people keep things separate. But also a variety of syllables, up to three usually. I don't usually go more than three for a name unless it's like for humorous purposes or something. So there's a name generator I use called Rinkworks that I find really inspirational. And you can generate short names, medium names, and long names. And it just is random, like letters and consonants in a name-like shape. Some of them will wind up being like real words or real names. Some of them will just wind up being kind of unpronounceable. But a lot of them are just really useful. And so I use that often as just inspiration and then develop a name off of what the kind of things I'm reading. So I could get, I ran an adventure called Sewers of Death on Saturday where the PCs were fighting gnolls. And so I wanted to give the gnolls short, punchy names that were also real words that had negative connotations. But there's a lot of variety in that. So I had a gnoll war priest who was just like a really mean guy and just wanted to fight the PCs, and his name was Rank. And then there was a gnoll zombie lord cleric of Lamashtu, and she was like a little brighter and kind of more in charge and more tactical, so I named her Malice. So I've got two different initials and two different syllable patterns, but the names are clearly related, like they sound like they're kind of from the same tribe or something like that. And there's also patterns you could use where the character name sounds like a fantasy name, so Valeros, for example, or something like that. Or you can use a... I know there's a technical grammar term for it, but I can't remember, where the name is made out of real words, so it could be like thief killer or, you know, far strider, that kind of thing. Or you can use a nickname, which often I like to do, so a brawler is called Knuckles or something like that. And so you're mixing up initials and you're mixing up syllables, patterns, and then you're mixing up types of names, from fantasy-sounding names to... I'll call them elf names, because often they were elves when I originally read them. I don't know why. They sound like elf names in my head. And nicknames. And that also can give the players a sense of that these are real people walking around in the world. You go around this room, I'm sure we all have like vastly different names, but they all sound kind of similar. And I guess a subcategory of that, too, is in the high school game that I made. It was set in California, I said. So another thing I did was just check the demographics breakdown of California, and I found that the two highest non-white populations were Mexican and Chinese. And so there were a lot of Mexican and Chinese kids in that high school. And if you're from California, that sounds real. And if you're not, it also sounds real because generally high schools are not just all one ethnic makeup unless it's in like an ethnic sort of neighborhood that some cities develop. And so varying the type of name by culture also can add some verisimilitude to your world, especially if you know, for example, that Absalom is really multicultural. So you're gonna have names from Kadira, names from Garen, names from the Lenorm reaches and things like that, as opposed to a little town in Versia, you'll probably have a lot of Chalaxian names and maybe a couple of Versians, but you know that ethnically they're often at odds, so maybe that's the kind of place where you'd have one part of town that's all Versian, and then the rest of the town would be Chalish. And so just thinking a little bit about demographics can really help influence your name generation, I think. And, oh good, we're fine. The other reason I wanted Robert here so that I didn't have to talk for like 40 minutes by myself. I could just drink coffee quietly, but they have to excuse me the occasional sip. Another thing I wanted to touch on briefly that I find really helpful is that in Wikipedia, I meant to look this up, so I don't know if the formatting is exactly right, but you can type list and then a colon and then shades of color. And I use that a lot when I'm describing colors in my writing. So list colon shades of purple, and then I'm getting, you know, ultraviolet and royal purple, imperial purple, and blue red and maroon and fuchsia and all those various shades. And just glancing through it can be helpful so that I'm not always saying the same shade. And when I worked on Runes of Aslant, I had to say the word blue a lot of times because there was a lot of blue things and people would describe the ocean as blue. Probably somebody's name was blue, I don't know. And so shades of blue was my go-to, because in my head I know there's azure and beryl and celandon and cornflower blue and all those great Crayola crayon names we remember from our childhood. But when you're writing, again, they don't always just pop to the surface conveniently, and when they do, sometimes it's ones you've already used because, you know, they're fresh in your mind. So these lists of color shades, don't just type shades of gray, go list shades of gray, because you get way different results.
Yeah,
that's
something completely different.
Mm-hmm. Where do you get that?
So that's a trick I use to make sure that my writing is sort of varied and interesting. In the same fashion, I have a couple bookmarked pages that I've just found over the years, and I'm sorry I don't have the names or the lists like exactly with me, but if you follow me on Facebook or if you find me on Facebook and message me and say, hey, can I have like some of your writing resources, I'll send you the links. But I've looked for different woodworking pages from different areas of the U.S. The U.S. is great because they tend to have like lots of websites for businesses, just because it's such a large country and there's so many businesses. And I can read them because I only speak English. And there's such a wide variety of climate over the United States. It's such a large country. So, you know, Mideast versus Midwest and Southern and Northern. And that gives me types of wood that are common to that area without having to look at forest information. And also just visuals of what that wood looks like words. So what does a mahogany bedpost really look like? I have an idea in my head that's often, you know, that's something that you might encounter in a fantasy game. But what does it really look like? How deep a brown is it? Is it kind of warm brown or is it sort of an ashy brown? And that can be really useful for just putting in those little details. And again, this isn't something that needs to take a lot of time. I have a lot of these resources at my disposal just because I've been writing for so long that I've developed a pattern over the years, and I've developed, you know, these lists of woods and metals to same. I've got, you know, things with lists of worked metals, what do they look like? And now I can just go and do like 10 minutes of reading online, as long as I don't start clicking on links and be like, oh, what is this all about? Oh, I'm learning so much about how to forge, you know, dinner plates or something like that. And then all of a sudden an hour's passed and I'm like, no, I was supposed to be writing. That's one of the perils of working freelance, working from home. Gotta stay focused, stay on target. And But the small amount of time you put into that research can have really good rewards for how detailed and interesting your writing is. There's one more. Oh, and on that note, there's a Tumblr blog, and I think also a webpage connected to it, called Writing with Color. And it's a diversity-focused website to help people write about races that are not their own, cultures that are not their own. And often they have master posts that you can find with a quick search where they list examples of different kinds of skin tones, different kind of hair textures and hair colors, and with tips on how to write them. So, for example, it's a little frowned upon to describe non-white skin tones as foods. It's kind of just weird and also very common. So like saying, you know, her skin was like coffee or caramel or something like that is, it's just a little weird when you really think about it. Like, these are things we eat.
What's the point of you character as a vampire?
Well, yeah, unless your character is a vampire. There was a funny post going around a while back where it was like, if writers described white skin tones the way they described darker skin tones, and it was like, you know, her skin was the creamy hue of mayonnaise. And
rice milk latte with way too much rice milk.
Exactly, exactly. So, you know, they have a lot of other suggestions that you can use instead. Actual just color words like different shades of brown, or, I know, likening things to different shades of wood or depths of metals and things like that. And it can work for all kinds of skin tones. So that's also something I look at when I'm designing NPCs or making a description of a person, just to make things interesting and realistic and give my writing that extra zing. One of my favorite authors is Raymond Carver, who's a famous American author and wrote short stories and poetry. And at one point, he was interviewed and said his guiding principle when writing poetry was that he looked for illuminating details, small details that would cast a different light over the whole poem or make the reader think about their life and life in general in a different way. So not just using poetic language, and not just creating beautiful scenes in the poem, but looking for specific details that would kind of bring it all to life. And I try to keep that as one of my writing principles, is to look for small details that are not going to take up a whole bunch of word space. They're not going to necessarily, you know, be a cool new mechanic or something like that, but that it's a small detail that people can resonate with. And it's served me well so far. Going back to Iron Fang Invasion momentarily, this isn't really about writing descriptions exactly, but it goes into character motivations, which is another aspect. Visuals are one kind of whole category to themselves. And I know we talked about names, that's not really a visual, but it's a concrete detail that the players are like seeing or experiencing and responding to. The character motivations can also have illuminating details in them. And it's one thing to have a dwarven blacksmith, and everybody immediately gets a picture in their head of a dwarven blacksmith. How about a dwarven blacksmith who is also a domino champion? He's got all these cool, like, different domino sets that he makes in his spare time. Or some domino awards on his wall on the smithy. It's like these shields where it's like domino champion 14 or whatever. Is it going to affect the adventure? Not really. Is it going to, you know, make the win an Emmy for amazing game writing? No. But your players were probably much more likely to remember the dwarf and think of him as a real character and not just a caricature that, you know, the dwarven blacksmith that we saw to get our armor fixed. Maybe in the future it will spark an adventure idea, or perhaps he'll get more developed as an NPC. But really the job is done as soon as the players notice that he's a little bit different and start thinking of him as a character in the game. Motivations can be helpful for GMs who are trying to detail or represent a character in the world. And the players may never know that NPC's backstory or whatever little quirk, but it can affect the GM and how they portray the character, how they think about the NPC, and give it a little more depth than just a caricature. In the Worldwind Incursion, there's, I don't know how many of you have read The Whirlwind Incursion. It's the first adventure path for Wrath of the Righteous. And the players start, there's a big incident in the city, and they fell down through like a pit down into the center of the earth kind of thing. And they're stranded with some other NPCs who were in the plaza during the time of the attack. And they have to make their way out to the surface. And one of the NPCs who falls down with them and needs to get out is a noble named Horgus Gwyrm. And he's not a pleasant fellow. He's actually really, really awful. He offers to pay the PCs, you know, a big reward if they get him to the surface, and suggests that they just leave the other people behind because, you know, they might slow them down. Somebody's leg is injured. And he's just like, it's everyone for themselves down here, you know. I'll give you 100 gold pieces if you abandon this injured person and get me out of here. And I haven't yet heard a story where a DM's like, yeah, my players totally took that bargain and just allowed the NPCs to their dooms. So,
in fact, my alchemist threatened to kill him instead.
So. There you go. But, you know, so he's a nasty fellow, and then he complains the whole time, and when he gets to the surface, he's really, like, just not grateful about it, and the players are meant to not like him, and he's also, like, a little wink of comic relief just because he's so awful. And when I was doing the character sheet form, or the character background form, I thought, nobody's just generally awful person for no reason. Like, they don't just, like, come out of the womb like, I'm a terrible person, and I'm going to be horrible my entire life. Like, he has to have reasons for the way he acts, because we all do. And it doesn't have to be, like, a tragic sob story or anything. But there's got to be something there to hang this character onto you. And so I decided that as a child, he came from a poor family. He was sort of the hired playmate for a rich noble family so that he would play with their kid kind of thing. And they were going on a trip one weekend in a carriage, and there was an accident, and the carriage crashed and burst into flame. I don't know. Probably that's what happened when carriages crash. They always burst into flame. Yeah, burning wheel rolls out of trouble.
Yeah.
Exactly. And everyone was killed except Horgus. And when someone came, you know, and pulled him out of the wreckage, they're like, are you okay? Who are you? And in a moment of inspiration, terror, greed, he said he was the noble child. He lied and said he was the other kid who had died in the carriage. And because the rest of the family died in the wreckage, he was shipped off to some distant relatives who were perfectly willing to accept him as this other kid. And he's lived his whole life under this assumed name, and that's how he got his fortune, how he made all his money. And inside, he's always secretly terrified that people are going to find out he's fake. And so he's very aggressive, and he's very reliant on his position. I am a noble. Look at all my money. Look at all my fancy clothes. Nobody could doubt this. And it doesn't change the character at all. He's still a super jerk. Like, you don't have to feel sorry for him or anything. But it explains a little more about him. And I think when the GMs are running or role-playing Horgus, it could add that extra dimension to his portrayal so that he's not just a jerk comic relief that is just horrible for the sake of being horrible. He actually has a little bit of depth to him. And if the players are interested in, you know, developing more of a relationship with Horgus Gwyrm, then that could, you know, maybe come out in different exciting role-playing ways throughout the game. So just to reiterate my mantra for this whole seminar, a little bit of work thinking of a small detail can sometimes bring a lot of returns in terms of bringing things to life inside the adventure. And the last sort of bit I'll touch on is culture and mannerisms and things like that. So we talked about kind of tactile, obvious things. We talked about motivations a little bit. Culture can also be really interesting in terms of small details. When we look around at our culture, whatever culture you happen to be from, there's a lot of different aspects to it. The kind of food we eat, the kind of the ways we prepare that food, religious rituals that we have, sort of social rituals like shaking hands or saying hello or what have you. When I was in business school, because I have a business degree too, I took a really, really interesting class called International Business, where it was basically all about going on trips to other cultures and how to how to act and how to do business in settings that are not familiar to you. And one of the things that we talked about was something, one of the things we talked about was the concept of personal space and how close people are comfortable standing in different cultures. And of course, people tend to default to whatever they were raised as. They're like, well, that's the default, clearly. It's only, you know, 1 foot and then somewhere larger and smaller. But it's just a range. Every culture and every person in a culture has a different sort of mental distance that it's cool to stand from somebody. And if that is broken, it can be really, really weird. So this doesn't have to be just standing and talking to somebody. I mean, it's one thing as a GM if you want to say, like, you know, the gnome comes up to talk to you and he's like really, really close. Like he's like really, really close. And you have to stand like that to talk to him. That would be weird, you know? Like it would feel strange. Or imagine if the gnome comes up to talk and you as the GM are saying, the gnome comes right up to you, like practically touching you. You have to crane your neck down to look at him. And as he's talking, he rests his hand casually on your knee. How are the players going to react to that? Some might be totally cool with that, like, oh, he's friendly, you know. And some might be like, this is really uncomfortable for me. So, and don't stop there. I mean, don't stop by saying, like, the gnome comes up and puts his hand on your knee. The player's like, oh, I take a step back. You can say, why? Why does your character not like being touched there? Is it because you, the player, think that's weird? Or is there something about your character why they would think that it's weird? And that might just, where they're like, well, people in my culture don't do that, or I'm not used to people standing so close, or I think he's hitting on me, or something like that. Or maybe they'll think about it and say, I don't know, actually, maybe my character would be cool with that. And it can be a quick, you know, role-playing moment. And one of the stories I'll never forget in that business class I took was our professor said, he was from Pakistan, and he mentioned going to, totally forgotten which culture it was, but whatever, he was in another country and they had cubicles in the office he was working at with a desk and a computer and a chair kind of a setup, you know, standard sort of office setup. And it was always arranged so that the cube had the door facing here and you had your desk facing the outside of your cube and the chair behind it and your computer. And people at the office, was common, you'd go into somebody's cube and then you'd walk around the desk and actually, like, put your hand on their shoulder and be looking at the computer screen and chatting. And he's like, I could not get used to it. It felt so rude to me to come into someone's office, walk around behind their desk, and be chatting and, like, looking at their computer screen. Like, it felt really uncomfortable, but everybody else did it. So, you know, if the players are in a foreign city, maybe, and they go to a bar, and it's really common to sit at strangers' tables. I mean, now it's common because we have communal tables. I don't know, restaurants thought that was a great idea. But maybe that's really weird for them. They're like, let's go grab a table at the inn and talk about, you know, our plans for doing the dungeon. And they go sit down at a table. And then, like, two, you know, mill workers come and sit and start talking about their day. And like, hey, so where are you from? And the players are like, we're having a conversation here. You
know? Particularly if they're talking about something much more sketchy, which players usually do.
You know? So that could be weird.
That's a really good idea.
Yeah, or they go to an inn and they're like, can we rent a room for the night? Sure, 2 silver pieces each. And then they go up to their room and it's like a giant like bunk room filled with bunk beds and there's like 3 other people in there. And like a bathroom down the hall, like it's a hostel. And that might be really weird. Maybe they'll get paranoid their stuff's going to get stolen. Maybe it will get stolen. Maybe one of the people in there is like their enemy in disguise. Yes.
Of privacy, like, is it okay to start making small talk with a stranger when you're on, you know, the ox cart out of town or whatever?
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. If you think of any sort of situation in which, and think of times when you've been around someone who did something rude and you were embarrassed, or you accidentally did something rude and you were embarrassed, how could you, you know, make that into an adventure? I was at a restaurant once at a different convention, and I'd met a couple people, you know, that we all kind of got around to. And we decided to go have lunch. So we went to a restaurant and we all got separate bills and one of the guys didn't leave a tip. And the waiter came by and kind of quietly said, was there anything wrong with the service? And he's like, no, I just don't have any more money. And I was like, oh my God. and I like slipped a five into the guy's, you know, pay thing quietly. And the person was like totally unconcerned. He didn't come from a culture where tipping was a thing, and he didn't see like that it was a big deal. And he thought the waiter was rude for coming and bothering him about it. And the guy was just like, I just wanted to make sure like you weren't, you know, that I didn't do something wrong when I was serving you. And so incidents like that, I can't think of a game analogy right now, but that sort of a thing where the players are around someone who's being unintentionally offensive, what are they going to do? Maybe they're at a noble party, and one of the NPCs that they're with, who's like a source of information, is just being really classless, and people are starting to look. Are they going to try and correct his behavior? Are they going to apologize for him, or quietly spread the word, like, oh, that's just the way, you know, he does things? Are they going to follow his example and be like, if we all do it, maybe it won't look weird?
Foreigners.
There's a lot of ways to use those kind of small moments to really bring a game or a piece of writing to life. And that gives us about 15 minutes or so to go. So if people have questions, now would be a great time. Yeah.
So on the subject of, like small details, you went over color and for plants and stuff. The main bane of my existence when doing description is architectural terms. Mm. Do you have any tips for managing those?
Honestly, I don't know a whole lot about architecture myself, so I tend to describe windows as being square and walls as being straight. On occasion, yeah, like if I'm describing a big temple or something like that, maybe I'll Google like old temples or something along those lines and take a look at the different types. And even if I don't know the specific architectural terms, probably the players won't either, so I can just describe what they look like and not being like, oh, it's a flying buttress. I can say, well, you know, there's these graceful support beams that arch up towards the ceiling and hold it aloft or something like that. I have started to experiment a little with materials. For some reason, I know that logically that medieval sort of analogies to a Pathfinder type tech level absolutely had glass working, glass technology. But glass windows still feel weird to me. Like I try to imagine them and I'm like, do they lift up? Like, is there a sash? Or is it just like a pane of glass like built into the wall? You know, I really try and think of it. So I've been trying to do more descriptions where it's like windows are, you know, covered in oil paper. That was also a common way to cover windows. And so it's just kind of translucent, not really. It's enough to let the light in, but you also get some privacy. But it would also make it really easy to break in. The windows are actually just paper. Or maybe they don't have any sort of glass or covering at all, but they have shutters. And so in the morning, everybody opens their shutters. And at night, everyone closes them and bars them. So that would be another way to get into a building. Same with doors. I tend to always picture just a big plywood sort of door with a handle on it. Maybe it's not that. Maybe it's a bead curtain, or maybe it's a maybe it's reinforced with metal on one side and has cool like engravings on it that make it really picturesque. Or even just maybe it's painted, so instead of just being wood colored, it's like bright red or peacock blue or something like that. That would add a little extra dimension to the building. Yes.
We talked a lot about getting sort of visual details. Do you have any suggestions about how to drag out like other sensory details,
like
the internet or just other inspirations?
So scent can be a big memory thing. I tend to use scent details more when I'm describing areas, but they can also completely help to describe an NPC or something else. I ran a game last night for some friends called Shaylin's Angels, where everyone was a Charlie's Angels style secret agent serving the goddess Shaylin to thwart.
I'm upset I haven't thought of that.
To thwart like art thieves and stuff, and it opened at a gallery. They got word that a valuable sculpture was going to be stolen by an evil art ransomer called the Philistine. And when they got there, I described like there's a gnome like art appraiser / art historian who's kind of doing a lecture on the different pieces, and I described him walking past and that they smelled a little hint of a floral cologne not overpowering. Clearly, he was sensitive to the noses of people around him when he did his toilet that morning. And I mean, it's just a small detail, but it's a big difference from someone being drenched in perfume or someone smelling like bread or something like that. Well, you know, maybe they're a baker, and so maybe that could be a clue. We must head to the bakery. And so, yeah, scent can definitely be a personal scent. Is it applied or not? Like, did they deliberately use that scent, or is it something inadvertent? How much did they put on? And cities, like I said, can have good smells. Taste is probably a little rarer to describe, although with things like potions, like I'm really into describing the visual look of potions. So if people are drinking potions and you start to give them an association, like healing potions always taste like cinnamon, or that potion of aid is so bitter. What did the cleric even put in this?
Arsenic, because he hates it.
Yes. And that can just have a fun sort of running thing that just pulls people into the world a little bit more. Yes.
So are there, for your work with any of the people that contracted with you, do you find that there's like established, like this is the color of blue or this is the flavor of healing potions?
Not in role playing as much. In video games, yeah. I worked on Baldur's Gate Siege of Dragonspear last year, so it was a Dungeons & Dragons isometric, you know, top-down role-playing game. Y'all know Baldur's Gate. And honestly, in my own games, healing potions are always blue because they are blue in Baldur's Gate. So if you're gaming with me, blue potion equals healing potion. So that's one thing. And colors of, say, uniforms and things like that. Like if a city guard is always wearing a particular color, that can become a strong association for players. In that Shaylin's Angels games, it was set in Absalom, and the players were on their way to somewhere, and I noted how the sun was starting to descend over the Western Ocean, and they could see the white sails of the ships from Taldor coming up, and the red sails of the ships from Cheliax coming from the other direction. And so that was a small color detail that showed that the world had some consistency to it.
Sort of a more on-the-fly kind of fluff. I do my best to describe what happens in combat, and often I actually find that I run out of interesting ways to say that it hits and it does damage without making it sound like their arm is about to fall off and have a mechanical effect.
Yes.
Do you have any kind of pointers on how to walk the line between the two?
Number one, I agree with you, totally. I don't have specific tips. Every now and then I think, you know what I should do is I should make a list of verbs and just have it handy so that as I'm thinking, I can, you know, as we're gaming, I mean, I can glance at it and use it for inspiration. I find that I really enjoy describing combat as well, though if I do it too much, I find that it can kind of slow down the sort of punchy excitement of a combat. So usually what I do is if it's an average, if they hit, I'll usually say, you connect with the enemy, or your sword slashes through his armor, or you slash an opening in his armor that you can take advantage of next time, or something like that. Sort of abstract the hit points, so that they're not necessarily every hit point equals like 10 cc's of blood, or something like that. or even something like, you know, you land a solid blow on the armor that clearly distracts him, and he staggers back looking shocked, so next round you're sure that you'll be able to take him down or something. And then save the, like, arm-severing descriptions for crits or really good hits, and of course, describing fumbles really well, so that's always fun. And in Wanted in the Wastes yesterday, I ran for the Aethera campaign. I had three ghost scorpions were attacking the players, and one of them rolled like two natural ones in a row. And I was describing the scorpion being like really confused, and like maybe it had like some rotting fruit for breakfast or something, and got a little tipsy. And the players are like, "What is wrong with that scorpion?" And they kind of felt bad for it, and were sort of just trying to like maybe kick it out of the shelter, like it would go in a different direction or something. So fumbles can be fun in that sense. We have 5 minutes, so one or maybe two more questions, if anyone has one.
Any thoughts with names of using names that are a translation of some adjective or something about that character from a language that is culturally appropriate, or not trying to do that?
In my home games, absolutely. I do that all the time. I also like going to baby name generators and searching like for meanings, where I'm like, this guy is going to be, you know, is secretly a kitsune. I'm going to search for fox names and see what pops up, and that kind of a thing. In published work, I have to be a little more careful. Usually, if for something like Kadira or something, Paizo has naming guidelines, and so I would just adhere to those. But in my home games, absolutely, looking at other languages can result in some really beautiful names. And the magic of Google Translate unites us all.
What do you use for resources when you're doing something that should be fairly non-human? So if you were doing, I don't know, Nigo or even gnomes or far more fey.
Yeah, that's also...
Starfighter coming up with a lot of aliens.
Yeah. I mean, to a degree, it's just something that sounds right to me. Like, maybe aliens have more, like, regimented mechanical names. Or maybe there's... sorry, I said aliens, I think, but I meant androids. And or maybe there's some androids who are really trying to, like, integrate with humans, and they have, like, almost humorously human-style names. Like, you know, this is Reggie the android, or something like that. And... For creatures that are enemies to the players, like monstrous creatures, I do tend to go more consonant heavy and use like short syllables. And it's there have been some studies that I've glanced at from time to time about how universally, like through all cultures, people tend to associate consonants with like spiky angular shapes. Like if you're matching word sounds to shapes. And then vowels are matched to like round, softer shapes. I don't know why someone was like, hey, let's make a study of matching word sounds to shapes. And so if something is like really spiky and angular, I tend to use a lot of consonants. And if something is like kind of more fluffy and friendly, like sheep or flumph, then I use more vowels. And in published settings, there's usually some guidelines for things like fey and gnomes for having names like that. And sometimes I'll also use like real world names, just older ones. Like I like to look at the census names, the most popular names in like 1910 or 1870 or stuff. That data all exists for the United States anyway. And maybe having someone named Priscilla might fit in with your particular, your name, or Honore or something like cool like that. That's not really in use anymore, but the players will know how to pronounce and will maybe make some connotations to them. Thank you all so much for coming and attending. I really had a great time talking. There's not too much con left, but if you're sticking around for a bit, please enjoy it and safe travels to you all.
Thank you for joining us for another edition of the No Direction Podcast PaizoCon 2017 seminar coverage, made possible with the help of Justin Sluder and Ryan Hiller of Geek Dad. To find more great Pathfinder audio, go to NoDirectionPodcast.com.